VentureCast.
Yeah. He would have been like, you can write a better lyric than that.
Oh, man. So
it made me miss South Detroit for sure.
What else is on that album? Anything good?
Oh, yeah. Only Time Will Tell was another huge hit. Do you remember
that
one?
How's
that go? Oh, it's Only this time one here. Oh, it's you'll know it right away.
Oh, stop. Oh, my God. Stop.
Lord.
Oh, my God.
No, stop it. Stop. Oh, stop.
Cowbell. Mind numbing cowbell.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
But I am going to start this podcast, fellas. How is it going today?
What a day.
What a day. It is 1982 on the podcast. Welcome to 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys on the Drive-In Podcast Network. Ben Barton, Knoxville, doing well these days?
Bumping along, for sure. A little rainy today, but otherwise good.
I hear you. Jeff Simons, Berkeley, is that sunshine over your shoulder?
Yeah, I'm actually still in sunshiny Marin County because right after this podcast, I slide right into a pickup hoops game. So, a very, very exciting Wednesday night ahead for the
nice. Excellent. I like
and then, it. And then right to the Marin County hot tubbing, I believe.
It was last week. I really played hard. I was really proud of myself. And as I was going to bed, I was like, things feel tingly. And the next morning, when I reached to kind of pull myself up into the school van to drive the kids to school, I grabbed the steering with my right arm and it made this noise. Pop, 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 pop. So yeah, I'm gonna be a lot more careful tonight.
It's funny.
Hurt for like 3 days.
It's funny you bring that up. Do either of you know the number one reason why I am not a professional athlete?
Because you suck.
Nope, that's actually further down the list. It's like four.
Are you sure? Because I think you might want to look into it further. I could say that's the same reason I'm not a professional athlete.
I was going to say, you don't like stretching. That's your number one.
Oh, no. Brian Shaw never stretched. Yeah, it's nothing to do with the skill set I have or the physical nature of my 5'11 frame. I can't stand losing. And tonight we lost a volleyball match to our rivals. And I almost broke my clipboard. I've grown, I've matured as a coach, but I cannot stand losing. And if you're like a Major League Baseball player, you're losing what? Like 50 games over a season?
The difference is when a Major League Baseball player loses 50 games, they go home and sleep on a giant pile of money. And when a high school volleyball coach who gives up all his free time, heart, and soul loses to the arch rival, you go home to asbestos basement. So I think that probably has something to do with it.
To the two of you.
Right. Oh, this is going to be a salty podcast. Listen up.
I'm going to go ahead and speculate that you're not mean to the girls.
I am not mean to the girls.
That just means that you're just like, you have to eat your little bitterness. It's just like, you keep it all in your little tum-tum just down there. That must be really hard.
You almost broke your clipboard, did you go around the back of the van before driving them home and like think about breaking it, or did you almost break it on?
No, it was in a moment of a lack of focus, and the student, the athlete, understood her mistake right away. So it's like, you don't
need the ball hitter in the head.
You don't need to break a clipboard to emphasize the point.
So you're like, I didn't break the clipboard. That's why I threw a chair onto the court and got escorted out of the building.
Fun stuff.
That's a good sub podcast, like favorite coach meltdowns. That's definitely number one. Bobby Knight's chair. I really love Denny Green's. Like, we knew who we thought they were.
I was going to say that.
I love that.
The thing that's really sad is that they were. These are only the public ones. Like, I can't remember.
Oh, I know.
I think it's Mike Leach when he was at Texas Tech.
Oh, yeah. That one's insanity. Yeah.
Where he says, I'm a man, I'm 40?
No. That's the Oklahoma State guy. The Texas Tech one is, and Jeff can correct me on this. My memory is fuzzy. But basically, it's like some guy who worked at ESPN's kid goes to Texas Tech. And he goes only because Mike Leach is an offensive genius and a great coach. And then Mike Leach like literally locks him in a closet for like 18 hours. And
what?
And he's like banging the door, like, let me out. I need water. Like, I need to get out of here. And he's like, you'll poop in your pants and live in that closet.
What?
It's Lampley's kid, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, I should have put it allegedly by all of this, but that was my understanding.
Allegedly. Oh, man. All right. Well, enough about...
Anyhow, Timmy, you got some new coaching tips, man. You're ready to do this.
Yeah, that listeners, if you're out there and you have some volleyball coaching tips, go ahead, tweet it at me. 1982. Let's get right to it. The Grammy winner, Jeff Simons.
It's the Grammy winner.
Toto 4 by Toto.
Martin, that was a long, long time.
I thought we were in Africa. I can't believe he snuck in Rosanna so I wouldn't know.
Key change, key change.
All right.
Hold on. Key change number 3.
Okay.
By the way, can you just see the West Side Story dance routine?
Yeah, that's right. The Jets.
I can't believe that's not in the musical Cats, that moment right there. Like
that is like... the Grammy-winning album. It's Toto 4 by Toto. How many bands have gone with the numbering route? So
that's
the
question.
Led Zeppelin.
Toto.
Toto.
Van Halen.
Four. Was that their fourth record?
Yeah, but they didn't do 1, 2, 3.
They're just not good at counting. Don't hold that against them, Jeff. That's rate true, them on a curve.
Urgent. Good. But just is Toto, because Led Zeppelin changes eventually. Does Toto?
Toto's Toto, yeah. In fact, I don't think it's Toto 2 and Toto 3. It's Toto and then some horrible name and something even stupider, and then Toto 4. So what I love about Toto 4 is it has that sword with the rings on it. It really, it's got everything about it. It's that red, like red velvet color. Like it's a tough package to love.
Africa's on it, right? That's the bigger single on it. Although maybe that's, Rosanna was bigger at the time. Africa's bigger now. I mean,
because like the girls, Weezer.
If you played Rosanna to the girls, they would have no idea, but Africa, they would know for sure.
Yeah.
Africa, Dolly even kind of likes that song.
Africa's the last song on the record and Rosanna is the first.
Yeah, that I know that record, man. That record was gargantuan. Although I guess we decided this, that Thriller comes out late in the year and that's why it didn't win anything. Like it's demented.
Yeah. It comes out in November.
Yeah. We're saving the Thriller chat because it's going to dominate.
If we could go over the last 5 years of Grammys, we go Saturday Night Fever in 78, 52nd Street, Christopher Cross, Double Fantasy, Toto 4. I feel like we're heading in the wrong direction.
Things are getting very soft. That opening drum beat of Rosanna, though, like just about every drummer I know is in awe of that opening drum beat because of the. There's something very, very fancy that Rick Murata is doing with the hi-hat like this. Huh. And then it gets all ruined by that horrible, all that junk on top of it. But that drum beat, I know like six drummers when they sit down to test out a kit.
Yeah, like they start with
break into that Rosanna drum.
Oh, that's awesome.
Like, so it's definitely like an inside joke. So,
all right, Jeff Simons.
Hold on, the albums still remain better than the songs. I mean, the albums still remain better than the songs. We don't have any tie yellow ribbon. Like, no matter how bad you think Toto 4 is, it doesn't touch the worst songs that we have.
Oh, no way. Yeah, totally agree. None of those records are, Christopher Cross is a pretty shitty record. That's embarrassing as a choice.
Right, but I mean, that being, like, one of the things that's funny about the albums, and I guess I'm confused about the songs, but I mean, the albums, they basically, it seems like they're choosing one of the three biggest selling albums of the year, and they're like, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure.
They're not listening. Yeah.
And so, you know, that puts some guardrails on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like some of those songs. When you get the best-selling album of the year, it's probably going to be sort of okay.
Yeah.
It's going to at least have one song you know on.
It's going to have at least one song that's not embarrassing. That's well said. Yep.
All right. So 1982, Jeff Simons, you remember who wins the Super Bowl in 82? Ben Barton, do you know who wins the 82? Super Bowl?
Wait. Is it when the Raiders beat the Vikings?
No.
32-14? No.
No. The San Francisco 49ers.
That's the one over Cincinnati?
Yeah. Where Joe Montana sees John Candy in the audience of the Super Bowl. It's like, hey, it's John Candy, like with a minute left as he's driving the team down. Klaus von Bülow is found guilty.
Oh, right.
In Newport? That was not a nice
Didn't Jeremy Irons play him in a movie? Wasn't there a documentary?
Reversal of Fortune. It's an amazing movie. I thought he beat the charge. Dershowitz was his lawyer.
Dershowitz comes in for the
appeal. Dershowitz wins the appeal, and that's what the movie's about. Got it. Yeah. Okay.
Reversal
of
Fortune.
Terrific. Dershowitz is less terrific, and it's really gone downhill from there.
Yeah.
But the movie's great.
Such a great movie. When he's like, you're a very strange man. You have no idea.
Oh, yeah, that's dude, right.
That's a Jeremy movie. Irons performance for the ages.
Really
He's
good.
Really killing it.
Do you remember on The Simpsons when Lisa goes over to the genius kid's house and they're playing anagrams?
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, Alec Guinness. And the kid goes, genuine class. And they say, good one, Lisa, Jeremy Irons. And she says, Jeremy's iron. And they say, that's very good, Lisa. Here's a ball. Perhaps you'd like to bounce it.
All right. Now, also in 1982, which movie wins Best Picture in 1982? And I will give you a hint.
81 is Gandhi, right? Gandhi won everything in 81. Anyhow, just give us a hint on 82.
It's Tootsie.
Oh, it's Chariots of Fire.
Chariots of Fire.
Oh, I thought it was Tootsie. Okay.
For those of us listening at home, I was running
in slow motion.
I've never seen the movie. Ben, you ever see it?
Yeah.
Good.
I've seen it too.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's super. It's just exactly like The Crown. It's like Oscar/Emmy bait. Like they speak with British accents and they're good looking and people are like, wow, how classy.
That's so funny. That's so perfect.
All right.
It's like The Crown, but older and slower. That's slow motion. Fire.
A crowd of 100,000 attends the first day of the World's Fair in 1982. And in the 6-month run, 11 million attended. Jeff Simons, what city hosts the World's Fair in 1982?
Knoxville, Tennessee.
Is correct.
Beautiful Knoxville, Tennessee. Yes, we still have the Sun Sphere.
I know. I've seen it many a time. Beautiful.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, that's city property now. So India and Canada's probably just like doing donuts inside it right now.
By the way, do they still do a World's Fair?
I don't know.
Is there even still
a World's
Fair?
Yes. I think they call it an expo. But dude, I went to one in Milan, Italy in 2014-15. It was freaking fantastic. It was super fun.
Is that
fun.
Right?
They stopped doing them in the U.S.
Is it like Epcot Center with no rides? Like, what is it like?
Oh, they have it's like the Epcot World Park. Like you go to the
just rock around
things. Yeah, it's the one in Milan was fantastic. The one in Knoxville, Tennessee lost. And again, I'll just be kind about it. I'll just if you want to put it allegedly in it, it definitely lost money. Uh-oh. And the two guys who put up all of the money ended up in a federal pen for stealing from their own bank. So that was discouraged future entrepreneurs from doing it.
So but if it's city property, we could do a podcast from the Sun Sphere.
Dude, listen, before Indy Kincannon was mayor, when I used to have a real inn at the city, I played poker up there multiple times.
What?
Like it was a construction site, and I can't say who it was because it was extra not legal, but the dude let us in and we played poker with him and we just hung out. Now that Indy is the mayor, I was like, can we go back? And she was like, oh no, that would be a violation of various regulations.
Absolutely right. Is the motto still around anywhere? Do you know the motto, Ben?
No, what's the motto?
Energy turns the world.
Oh, so true.
Coal turns the world.
There was there was a Patriots Steelers exhibition game held in Knoxville in honor of the World's Fair. Nice. There was a Celtics 76ers exhibition game held there. It gives us touch screens. The first touch screens came from, were debuted in 1982 in Knoxville. Pay at the Pump debuted, and
that must have been a thrilling exhibit. Hey, kids, come look. Come look, you can pay at the pump.
Like, I'm so glad I'm alive for this moment, Paul.
That was
first of all, I didn't appreciate that accent, Jeff Simon.
Yes, you did. You loved that accent.
I did not like it. Oh, dude, on a related
topic, goes to
Dahlia, my beloved older daughter, Dahlia, is a philosophy major and an anthro minor at Haverford College. And she reported to me the other day that one of her professors was running down the South and that she would be scared to go. And Dahlia was like, well, I just have to say that, you know, you've mentioned that we shouldn't stereotype. And as a resident of Appalachia, I'm very upset. That's the greatest joke of all time. I was like, you do that thing, Dahlia. I love it.
Resident of Appalachia. That's great.
The other debut was Cherry Coke at the Knoxville World's Fair in 1982.
Well, that's in a can, right? I mean, they were putting cherry syrup in Coke before the World's Fair. A cherry phosphate surely predates 1982.
Don't attack the research department, man. We talked about this. Let Timmy live, okay? If he says Cherry Coke came out then, it came out then. Nobody needs to hear about Dr. Pepper. Like, Cherry Coke started then, stop talking.
I'm just saving him angry later bad reviews. Like, I had a Cherry Coke in 1965 and a phosphate.
First of all, Jeff, you write those reviews, man. So you can save him by not doing that.
Oh, man. All right. Ah, Jeff, this one's for you. May 30th, 1982, Cal Ripken starts for the Baltimore Orioles. What year is the year where he takes a game off?
Oh, I can't. It's 1997, I think. Is that when he makes it through?
You're really good. All the way to 98. 16 years, never misses a game, which I kind of think this podcast is the Cal Ripken of podcasts. Every Wednesday, we're there.
For another 16 years, ladies and gentlemen.
Except for the month and a half we took off this summer, but you know.
Yeah, well, that's the off season. We can do that.
Sure, fair.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff Simons, I'm going to you for the number one selling album of 1982. It is not Thriller, because Thriller comes out in November. So this band gets to lay claim, although Thriller is the greatest selling album of all time that was released in 82.
And I'm gonna try to hit stop as fast as I can because Ben should be able to get this in less than a second.
And you're going with the big one, right?
Yeah.
All right, great.
I didn't get it.
Have it yet?
Oh!
That's my boy. That's my boy.
That's fine. I just needed those last two closing notes. Wow.
Keep it going, Jeff.
Really?
It's the number one album.
Asia by Asia.
I never meant to be so bad to you. One thing I said that I would never do. A look from you and I would fall from grace. And that would wipe the smile right from my face. To another, we were young, and we would scream together songs unsung. It was the heat of the moment.
Woo!
Telling me what my heart meant.
Can we just talk about how awkward that moment is? It's bothered me my whole life.
It was the heat of the moment.
Telling you what my heart meant. It's such a weird, unsingable medley, and the song gets all weird and rockabilly after being like a big power chord.
It's so good. So this is another one, Timmy, where I'm like, why isn't it Journey? Couldn't we just have Journey?
Put Journey.
Because at least one of these dudes was in Journey, right?
I don't know. This is Carl Palmer, the drummer. It's Greg Lake. Those guys are from Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. And yes. And then Greg Wetton, who was also in a bunch of those big prog rock.
But this is an all-star band with two really good guitarists.
Steve Howe.
Right?
Steve Howe is from Yes, is one of the guitar players, I think. Yeah, okay. This is a British super group of progressive rockers on the way down who very cleverly are like, why are we not making big, stupid pop music? We're all really spectacular.
I did not know.
And
I
get arrested.
No yep. wonder
one reason
I thought...
why they should not have made pop music is that they rhymed dance with circumstance. I was like, what is going on here, fellas? I can't believe, I mean, I own this record. And my recollection of this is that the guitarists were the big stars in the band and that they toured on an X-shaped stage.
Oh, no, that's GTR, but it's the same guy.
Are you sure?
Yeah. GTR was an X. They put the drums in the center, the guitars in the front, and the bass and the vocal in the back. Just the greatest stage design of all time. The
I
best
really
review.
Thought that was Asia, but that makes me happy. Whoever it was, that makes me laugh really hard.
But it's the same two guys. Like GTR was the super group that came out of the Asia split. And I can't remember what the other guys became. But so, the best album review I ever read in my life was of GTR. And the review was SHT. I was like, that is perfect.
That's
JD Considine, man.
Super
so
good.
Funny.
That's outstanding. So yeah, John Wetton of King Crimson.
Yep.
Steve Howe of Yes. Jeff Downes of Yes. And the Buggles. Carl Palmer of Emerson, Lake, Palmer.
Yep.
Wow. No wonder I always got these guys confused. Like Yes and Emerson, Lake, Palmer and everyone.
I honestly thought that there was a dude from Journey in there. Like that's how confused I was.
we should be so lucky. Yeah. He would have been like, you can write a better lyric than that.
Oh man. That so
it made me miss South Detroit for sure.
What else is on that album? Anything good?
Oh yeah, Only Time Will Tell was another huge hit. Do you remember
how's that go?
Oh, it's Only this time one here. Oh, it's you'll know it right away.
Okay, oh, stop. Oh, oh my god, stop. Oh, my god.
No, stop it. Stop
oh,
it.
Oh, my god. Stop it.
Cowbell! Mind numbing cowbell!
That keyboard sound, man.
So
that keyboard sound is the worst.
You don't know this about me, but when I get a keyboard gig in a band and I set up, the first thing I do is that, just to see if anybody will know it and start laughing. But the other day I was sound checking at that gig I played 2 weeks ago, and I set up the keyboard and I went and nobody said anything. And then I came down after the sound check and I'm walking to get my food, and this old guy comes up and was like, hey man, was that Asia you sounded? And I was like, it sure was, my brother. And he's like, sounded good. It was so great. It was
that
so
is glorious.
Great. Oh, good Lord, that song.
Yeah.
Ciabatta bread.
By the way, if that's not the opener of next week's podcast, I quit. Ciabatta bread. 50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
Is invented in 1982. Now, I figure bread was really old. And I figured ciabatta bread was an old Italian bread. Nope. Guy invents it in 1982 because they kept losing customers to a French bakery down the street. And those baguettes were making great sandwiches. This is why people come to our podcast. It's not music knowledge.
By the way, I really dislike ciabatta bread. I never get it when it's an option. Not a
why?
Fan. What? I don't know. I prefer crunchy. Many other kinds. I like the Dutch crunch, but I don't like the ciabatta. I feel like ciabatta is too thick, too much bread, not enough stuff.
Wait, Ben, that's why you have a sour face, because ciabatta is the high gluten bread. You're out on ciabatta.
That's why. That's why, too. I'm not mad about this entire topic, but you're right. That's it, because of the gluten content.
I hit a nerve. Sorry. All right. Barney Clark receives an artificial heart in 1982. He lives for 112 days. Can we think about this for a second? It's an artificial heart, Jeff Simons. It's man-made. It's plastic. Yeah. How the heck did he live for 112 days?
I always heard that story and thought, well, that's a shame that that didn't work. It doesn't seem like a great success to me. 3.5 months.
It's like an artificial brain, like the heart. You need a heart.
It's not like an artificial brain. It's like an artificial heart. They're very different. We understand almost everything about the heart. The brain is a gigantic, crazy ass mystery to this day. Would you agree, Ben? I mean, I'm not a doctor, but
I mean, basically, like the heart is a muscle, and they're awesome at dealing with muscles. Like, if you're going to have a bad part of your body, the heart is not a bad one to choose for sure.
So ciabatta bread, what they do is they put, never mind. All right. Oh, you guys are going to be mad about this. And then we'll get to our three albums. Time's Man of the Year for 1982. The Computer.
You're kidding me. I was going to guess E.T.
Yeah, could have been.
The Computer.
The Computer.
And by Timmy, help me out. Was the picture of the Apple IIe or what was it?
Oh, that's a great question. Here, tell Jeff about the Bee Gees documentary and I'll look.
Oh, did you watch it? Because I have a documentary I need to talk about as well that's music related.
Great. You do. I'll tell you that my beloved wife, India Kincannon, said, Tim told me to watch the documentary. And so we watched it together. And so I can report that I still love my wife. Second, I can report that it did not convince me that any of the pre-disco era or the post-disco era was very useful. In fact, it convinced me of the opposite.
Oh, my.
It was likable, though. They seemed like likable fellas. And in particular, I mean, the disco era, what can you say about it? Like it was even more impressive when you saw in the documentary, like just how freaking gigantic they were. And then it is a little like it was hard to generate much sadness because they were like in bathtubs full of money. But it must have been really weird for them to have this long career where they were up, down, and by up, I mean like tiny ups and pretty big downs. And then all of a sudden they were the biggest stars in the world. And they just ended, like just a curtain came down on them.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jeff, tell us yours.
I watched If I Leave Here Tomorrow, the Lynyrd Skynyrd story the other night.
Whoa!
Because it was Netflix's main recommendation to me. And I was like, why tempt fate? So I watched the whole thing.
Okay.
This is a very sad story. So people know that Lynyrd Skynyrd guys died in a plane crash.
Yes.
Did you know that there were 20 people on board and that 6 of them die and the other 14 lie dying in the wreckage for 24 hours before they're found and discovered while people howl and slowly expire in the wreckage lying around them? It is the most macabre, awful plane crash story. Because they basically land the plane enough to save most of the people.
Where was it that they landed?
In a field they were, you know, air failure trying to get to Mississippi and they crashed in somewhere in Georgia. But they went out to the farm and the guy listed like, oh yeah, there's still wreckage all over the place. Here, hold on a second. He starts digging. He's like, yep, there you go. There's a piece of the plane. He digs it out of the ground. And
oh my God. Out of the camera.
But here's what I have to say.
Okay.
Sometimes, you know, you watch a rock and roll documentary and people tell you stories and you're like, that didn't happen that way. Like there's embellishment. The Lynyrd Skynyrd guys are not capable of embellishment, which is a kind way of saying you get what you get with the Lynyrd Skynyrd fellas. And this is a story that the lead guitarist tells. Well, I mean, all I wanted to do was play my guitar. So in 10th grade, I got there. They were like, you should go home. And I was like, I'm going home. I just want to play my guitar. And they were like, you go in and get. And so 10th grade, I left. I never came back. And I think that's exactly the conversation that gently pushed that guy out of organized education. I mean, thank God Lynyrd Skynyrd hit for that guy. It was great. Really entertaining and very sad.
Ben, you got to look up Time Magazine Man of the Year 1982 because I cannot describe the picture.
three albums.
Ben, what do you got?
Oh, all right. I'm up. Okay.
You're up.
So first, I need to apologize to the lovely Indie Can Cannon for choosing a live Rush album. It's a cold reception. There was a cold reception. And then I don't know if you remember, but Jeff followed it up with another unlistenable punk record. And I'm quoting Indie Can Cannon on that. So we're in a tough spot.
What did you think of mine?
Technically, it's listenable because she heard it and hated it. So you can actually hear it. It doesn't mean you like hearing it.
Did she like Journey?
We're in a tough spot coming into this year, for sure. And I chose a song from Thriller in the Song of the Year. So I'm not going to choose that as Album of the Year, but I just want the record to reflect that that's the Album of the Year. That's the best album artistically and financially that came out of this year. I love that record.
Okay.
Second, I would have chosen the Violent Femmes record, but we already talked about that, so I can't do that. I almost went with Duran Duran Rio just to keep Indie Can Cannon happy. And I have a huge soft spot, particularly for the song Rio.
Okay. Oh, so Ben's college band did the definitive version of Rio, including Duran Duran's. They played the shit out of that song.
So I have a huge soft spot for it. But the rest of that record is so a tough listen. It would be hard for me to recommend that as an album overall. Same with the Go-Go's Vacation. Vacation is one of my all-time favorite songs. I literally sing it every time we go on vacation. But the rest of that record's tough. Prince 1999 was something that came to me. But there's a single record that I listen to more than any other record from this year, and I'm sad to report it's Van Halen, Diver Down. That's the record I know best from this year. That's the record I like best from this year. Okay. Jeffrey K. Simons.
Please choose the best song.
What is Van Halen's best-selling album?
Woo.
5150.
It's either one or 1984. I don't know which one.
5150.
Squeaker, and it's one. What is their second best-selling album?
1984.
1984, and they're just like just right there at the 15 million albums mark. 5150 would be their third best-selling album, which I am embarrassed to report. I'll have a 5150 story in a second. Dude, it goes Van Halen 1, which charted for three straight years and was their best-selling record until 1984 by a mile. Put these in order of sales. Halen 1, Halen 2, Women and Children First, Fair Warning.
Halen 1
is
first. I'm going to go Fair Warning, Women and Children First 2.
Dude, it's the opposite.
No way! All right.
It goes Halen 1, Halen 2, which is 7 million copies, Women and Children First, which is like right around 5 million copies. And Fair Warning is their worst selling record until Van Halen 3 in whenever that came.
Oh, wow.
And that's the one that's got like the third, fourth singer in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Gary Cherone, yeah.
So Fair Warning is their worst selling album for a long period of time. They're on a long tour for Fair Warning. And actually, I was reflecting on this, Timmy. Remind me the name of the guy we had as the guest on the Halen pod.
Brian Koppelman.
We had Brian Koppelman on. And we basically threw Tim under the bus and said that Koppelman hung up on us because Timmy chose a Van Hagar song. But he was already mad at us, Timmy. Do you know why he was already mad at us?
I can't remember, no.
He's an old school Halen guy.
Yeah.
And he considered Jeff and my praise of Diver Down to be apostasy. Because if you're an old school Halen guy, the story goes, Fair Warning is where they really hit their artistic peak. It's the most stripped down record. It's the most angry record. It's the record that Indie Can Cannon would have the least use for, even including Eruption. Like, she would just have no use for Fair Warning at all.
Oh, yeah.
And then Diver Down, there is a sellout record that leads to 1984. Like, the old school Halen guys consider Diver Down to be the gateway drug to 1984. So I think he was already mad.
Because they're all out on 1984 is bad to them?
1984 is a disaster, and then that creates Van Hagar.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And by the way, I mean, Jeff will agree. I mean, there's some good stuff on 1984, but it's bad. It's bad. And Jump in particular. Like, I mean, it was just really, he learned all the wrong lessons. Like, things really went downhill from there. Diver Down, however, I disagree. I disagree with the Halen heads. So they finish up the Fair Warning tour, and basically the record company's like, I don't know if y'all are paying attention, but every record sells less than the last record. And we're just going to have a meeting with you about that. So David Lee Roth goes to Eddie, and he's like, you know, let's put out a single. Let's just put out a single so that everybody, like, we can get played on the radio. We can fix this. And Eddie's like, okay, what should we do? And David Lee Roth's like, let's do Dancing in the Streets. And Eddie's like, really? Like, that, we can't do Dancing in the Streets. That's a bridge too far. Let's do Pretty Woman by Roy Orbison. And Roth is like, fine. They put out Pretty Woman. And it's insane when you go back and look at it all the way through For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge, and I won't spell it out for you. these guys have actual radio hits.
Like, oh, yeah.
Their cover of Pretty Woman hit number 12 on the Billboard charts. Like, it was a gigantic, massive, like, pop radio hit. The song charts, the record company's like, that's it, put out an album. And they're like, well, we just were on tour for a long time and we're going to write a bunch of new stuff. We don't have time to do that. And they're like, did you hear us? Put out a freaking record. We don't care. They like got off the cattle prods and were like, get in the studio. Van Halen goes in the studio for 12 days and they record this record.
Wow.
There's 4 or 5 covers on this record.
Wait, what are the covers?
All right. So the worst, the one that I like the least, I'll be curious if George agrees, if Jeff agrees, Where Have All the Good Times Gone?
Okay.
That's track one, and that's a Kinks cover. Then they go Hang 'Em High, which is a freaking great, fantastic song, but it's just a rework of one of the songs that they wrote as their demo before they got signed. Like, they literally just, like, they just wrote new lyrics for it, and that's the second song. The third song is Cathedral, which is an instrumental, and Jeff played that last time. That's like this amazing, really pretty, but it's volumes, a minute. Well. Yeah. Minute and 23, one where he's just working the volume pedal on his guitar. Then there's Secrets, which is like a total throwaway Van Halen song. But again, I just absolutely love that.
Love it. I love Secrets. So great.
Then there's Intruder, a minute 39 one that's just like Eddie going on his guitar for a minute 39. Then we get Pretty Woman. Then side two, we get Dancing in the Streets. Then we get the Spanish flamenco Little Guitars intro, Little Guitars. Then we get Big Bad Bill, parentheses, and Sweet William Now, which I'll return to. Then we get The Full Bug, which is another one, which is like this old blues song that they've just been hacking around where they're just like, yeah, fine, whatever. Like, we're trying to make a record here. They shoved this in the studio. And then the last one, Timmy, but you haven't heard it. You're not going to like it. You're going to love it. A 1 minute and 3 second all acoustic a cappella version of Happy Trails.
I think I remember that. Yeah.
It's so freaking great. It's hilarious. The whole album has this whole like F you, we don't care mood to it. It's such a random collection of things.
It's also 27 minutes and 34 seconds long.
Fair Warning is like super stripped down. And one of the things that was funny about Fair Warning is that every record, Eddie took longer to write his parts and to record his parts because he's a perfectionist and he's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant musician. This record, when you read the interviews about him, first of all, he's not crazy about this record. When you read the interviews about him, he's like, yeah, they threw me in the studio, man. I just like, that was the first take. Like the guitar solo on Secrets, it's rough. I make a couple of mistakes. That was the first take. And I was like, whatever, next song.
Wow.
And that energy is just like super lovable on this record. Big Bad Bill is Sweet William Now. It's a really, really dumb, bad song written by David Lee Roth. It's a jazz song a guy in Louisville who used to fight a lot, who gets married, and now he's Sweet William. They bring
clean up the dishes.
Oh, my God. They bring in Eddie Van Halen and his brother's dad, who used to be a professional clarinetist, to do like a like the cantina scene in Star Wars clarinet part. And it is fantastic. And they actually had to talk his dad into doing it because apparently his dad stopped being a professional musician because one of his fingers got mauled. Like he only had 4 working fingers. And he was like, I can't play anymore. And they were like, it'll be fine. And like, that's the mood of the entire record. It's a great, it's not a good, it's a great, it's hard to say. I mean, Halen won. It's hard to beat Halen 1. I mean, that may be, that's like up with some of the Hendrix records as one of the great guitar records of all time. This is not that exactly, but Eddie was so burned out from the Fair Warning thing. It's just like a huge chorusy record. There's like a lot of like synthesizer sounds on the guitar, and it's super pretty sounding. And it's just a really, really, really lovable record. If you haven't, I mean, go back and listen to the covers. Like the first 5 seconds of Dancing in the Streets, he's got this like digital delay where it sounds like it's a keyboard, but it's not. It's just Eddie alone on the guitar making all of these different noises on it. The guitar part for Pretty Woman is unbelievable. Like, dong, 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 like just so vicious. But I've already mentioned it. My favorite song on the record is Little Guitars. I'm going to ask Jeff to start at 1:57 so you can get the end of the chorus, and then you can get Eddie's like really super interesting and tasty guitar work, and then you get another the sub chorus.
Diver Down by Van Halen.
You and me.
So they
love
first the guitar part in there. So pretty, so full. It's like he fills it all up. Second, I mean, just the hidden secret weapon to Van Halen. And actually this, Timmy, you'll like this from the Bee Gees documentary. It's the same secret weapon from the Bee Gees. Like the harmonies.
Yeah.
These guys could have been a freaking barbershop quartet. Like they sound fantastic.
Now, does Eddie sing at all, or is that just Michael Anthony and David Lee Roth?
No, Eddie sings too.
He does, yeah,
and okay. The brother Alex and Eddie. I mean, they are really, really super highly trained, classically trained musicians. I mean, this is one of the things that's funny. They're Dutch. They moved to the U.S. from the Netherlands when they're 7, and then once I didn't realize that. I was like, oh man, that explains so much. Like they had this like Dutch fastidiousness to them. You know what I mean? And like the in the instrumentation and in the singing. Yeah, no, man. So all of those, like those backgrounds, the Van Halen sound is really, really, really unusual for basically a guitar / metal
right.
to have like those sort of pretty things. And that's what's so funny about the Happy Trails. Like the Happy Trails is just perfect. Like they hit every single note. They're hitting the 3 and sometimes even 4-part harmonies. Like it's just amazing.
Wow.
All right, you're getting a little bit of that. You've now mentioned the Happy Trails 4 times. So also it's got this beginning, like F you, are we recording or not? That sums up the whole record. Like
bomba dida 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 dida
dida. Something about that dida 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 that makes me laugh.
Dude, and it's David Lee Roth who's doing the stupid bass line. That's how good the other singers are. They slapped the lead singer on the joke part of the song. They did not get along, and this is part of why they broke up, but somehow they hit this like weird medium point here where Eddie was basically folded to David Lee Roth, but still kept enough of the reins on so that it wasn't full on jump, basically. Let alone the, like, I mean, as soon as like David Lee Roth goes off on his own, it's like nothing but I'm just a gigolo. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
But this one, he manages, they manage to hit the thing where they're working together. And it's a little, I mean, it's sort of funny for Van Halen. Like, they just never, like, I understand why they didn't get along, but they never found another singer that brought out the best version of them.
Mm-mm.
Jeffrey Symonds, we know who took over, Sammy Hagar. Two other singers were offered the job, at least according to Wikipedia, before Sammy Hagar. Timmy's got his hand up.
Let's hear it.
Is it possible it was Patty Smythe from Scandal?
Yes! Patty Smythe of Scandal. And I know her career. When I read that, I was like, holy shit, Patty Smith? That would have been amazing. And I was like, no, wait. Sorry, Patty Smythe.
Love her.
Okay, Timmy, you're going to be even more excited by the next name.
I don't know it.
Jeff, you want to take a stab?
Male or female?
Male.
Lou Graham from Foreigner.
Now, he's been featured in one of Timmy's picks, Daryl Hall.
Oh, God.
What? Can you believe it?
What?
That would have been so great.
Like Hall and Oates were gargantuan. I think H2O comes out this year or the next year. I mean, they are among the biggest stars in the world. But can you imagine how freaking funny it would have been?
John Oates would not have stood by to watch that happen. He would have fought.
First of all, John Oates, they would have been like, "Well, you're the guitar tech now. Like your job is to set up Eddie's guitars. That's what you do." While Daryl Hall sings and he plays.
You're the guitar tech.
That would have been amazing. And honestly, it might have been better than Van Hagar. It really might have been better.
Yeah. Yeah.
What would those songs have sounded like with him? I'm trying to hear Ain't Talk About Love and like with Daryl Hall singing it.
Yeah.
My love is rotten to the core. I mean,
it does seem unlikely. It seems likely we would have gotten even more keyboards. So I doubt I would have been happier with it.
That's true.
Wow. That would have been a step down for Daryl Hall. I mean, he must have been offended. It's like, you guys opened for us. I mean, the Hall & Oates is the biggest selling band in the world in 1983. Yeah.
But I'll tell you that the reason why Brian Koppelman doesn't like that album seems pretty clear. Like, cover. They must have been like, what are you guys doing?
Well, it depends on what you want from Van Halen. Like, I'm all with Ben on this. I love Diver Down. My version of Van Halen that makes sense is the party band where you can hear bottles clinking in the background and you're in the rehearsal studio with them. And you're just going to play all night and Eddie's going to occasionally shred and then he's occasionally going to hit on your girlfriend. That's the version of Van Halen that's palatable and tolerable. The version that takes itself seriously and is going to make capital A art is silly and ridiculous. If you're going to have a clown prince as your frontman, you've got to lean into the clowniness or you just seem absurd. So like that, I disagree with the hardcore Van Halen people. Like these guys were making seminal works of art. When they did that, they looked silly. When they were like, hey, what we can do? They were great. And Diver Down is the perfect example of that. It sounds like a house party. It's nothing like a house party where your house party band is Eddie Van Halen's.
They actually stopped doing covers. This is the last record where they do a significant number of covers. And the reason why is that Eddie was like, it's such a pain in the ass to do the covers, man. Like, I basically write a new song. I rearrange the entire song because I'm such a fastidious freak. And so there's no point. I should just write my own song. And if you look, Dancing in the Streets is the most obvious example of it. Like, that's a super basic song where he would just be like strumming behind David Lee Roth singing. So instead of doing that, he does this like super complicated, really, really, really technically. And I think it's quite a beautiful part.
Yeah.
But that's part of it too. I mean, like, not to be mean to Fair Warning, but the songs aren't good. Like Unchained is a freaking fantastic song. But the rest of the songs, like, you can't hum to them. You can't sing along to them. They don't have great melodies. You know what I mean? Like, in comparison to a song like Dancing in the Street or Pretty Woman, like, it just doesn't, they don't compare.
Wow. All right.
Jeff K. Simons,
what do you got?
Send your cards and letters, Van Halen friends, to Benjamin Hornbarton at. So, sometimes great music comes from the places you would expect, comes from America, comes from England. Occasionally you get bands from other places. What's interesting about smaller scenes is how they can create kind of their own thing, and it can, and especially in the days before the internet, when it would take like 4 or 5 years for a band to break out of a small, unusual space, they've already gone through 2 or 3 iterations. They've written through their first round of bad material. They've learned who they are. And so when you finally get a chance to hear them, you're not hearing a brand new band. You're hearing a band that's like has figured out who they are. Australia is one of those places.
Hey, now.
Bands that make it out of Australia tend to be really interesting because they've been honed by a hyper-competitive, like if you're from Australia or New Zealand, like there's like 4 cities, maybe 5. And those are the 5 cities you play. And then you come back 2 months later and you play them again and you play them again. Everybody knows everybody. It's super hyper competitive. And to be a band that people will come back and see again and again and again, you have to be really good. And so not only do bands from that country tend to be good, but they tend to be interesting. AC/DC is an interesting take on hard rock. They took some things and borrowed them from other bands, but then they did some things which nobody else was doing. Even a band like Split Enz is an interesting new wave band. Like, you compare a Split Enz record to the other like classic new wave bands like Squeeze or some of those other kind of poppy. Like, Split Enz is angular and there's all these crazy ass chords. They're incredibly hard songs to play. And Tonight's Choice for 1982 is another one of those very strange Australian bands that by the time you get to 1982, they have actually already made three records, but this is the first record released internationally. So as far as the world is concerned, it's a debut record.
Oh.
So here's a little story. I used to belong to something called the Columbia Record and Tape Club. Now, for those of you who are under 55 years old, the way this worked is in the Sunday newspaper would be an ad of a really happy guy or gal holding like 13 records. And it would say, if you tape a penny to this ad and cut it out of the newspaper and circle the 13 records you want, we will send them to you for a penny.
Unbelievable.
And you have joined the Columbia Record and Tape
Club. Such a great deal.
And then every month we'll send you an opportunity to buy another record. And all you have to do is buy seven more at regular club prices. Well, the problem, of course, is regular club price was like twice as much as a regular record at the time. And if you missed and forgot to send back the selection of the month card, you got the crappy album they chose for you. It was a huge hassle. But the way to make the club work was to join, get the records, buy all the records as fast as you could, quit. They would call you back and offer you a better deal. And then you could work the record clubs against each other. You could also, like certain scofflaws I know, join the club under the name Larry Led Zeppelin. Order the entire Led Zeppelin catalog and then never talk to the club again. Even after the sending Larry Led Zeppelin warning we break thumbs letters for being a breach of contract. I was a member of this club a million times and I bounced it off of other clubs. And Midnight Oil was a band you read about. They sounded really cool. They sounded like they were super energetic and punky. And they weren't on the radio. You couldn't find the records because the only three records were on an Australian label. And then they finally got an American deal and I ordered it from the Columbia Record and Tape Club. I ordered the record of the moment, which is called Red Sails in the Sunset. They were touring America for the first time on it. And the morons at Columbia sent me the wrong Midnight Oil record. They sent me the 1982 international debut, which was called 10987654321. And I was like, this is the wrong album. I should return it. And then after about 10 seconds, I was a kid with a new record in his hand. I was like, well, I should listen to the debut. Well, you should really start at a band's discography. I talked my son, I put it open and I'm expecting like wild guitar music. Put the thing on and this is how the first song starts. And I'm like, what in the hell have I just bought? This, you know, it's this weird kind of Kyoto sounding synthesizer song with all these backwards drums. I'm just like, where the hell is the angry band? And I'm like, you know, the song's ending and I'm like, oh, I've made a huge mistake. You know, who are these guys? Then I got to the second song.
I'm locked in my room.
That's more like it. Wow. That is more like it. You hear that ping? That sounds like there's an anvil being hit with the snare drum. It's a giant metal drum that was part of the kit. He's hitting a snare in this giant old oil container at the same time, like, bang! This is a furious record. It's about all kinds of stuff. It's mostly about feeling out of an important conversation as an Australian, like being out of the international conversation about human rights, about the climate. Peter Garrett, the lead singer, is a 6'7" bald former rugby player who actually ran successfully for national office in Australia when the band stepped away in 1993. These songs, they are brilliantly written. They're brilliantly arranged. These guys know how to take apart and do everything with it. And this record has everything. It has long, crazy soundscapes. It has break all the furniture in your living room, jump up and down rock songs. Some of the melodies are incredibly beautiful. Some of them are totally weird. It has wonderful experiments with electronica without losing the kind of full rock band sound. I fell in love with it on the first listen. After all these years, it's still my favorite Midnight Oil record by a mile. I'm the Midnight Oil guy who was really disappointed by the hit records. Like, I didn't love Diesel and Dust. I didn't like The Dead Heart. I didn't like Beds Are Burning. I didn't like Blue Sky Mine.
Wow,
they
really?
Were so restrained. Like, those songs sound to me like Midnight Oil trying to kind of hold it together to have a hit record. This record does not give a rat's ass about restraint. And so if you'll indulge me, I'm gonna play the first 30 seconds of my favorite Midnight Oil song, the best song on this record, and I think their best song overall. It's called Read About It. I finally got to see Midnight Oil live like 3 years ago. Midnight Oil took a 20-year break and then did an anniversary tour and toured the world. And because they took a 20-year break, they're in incredible shape. I mean, these guys are all like 7 or 8 years older than we are. They looked amazing. Like, yeah. I just couldn't believe how in shape they were. They played 2.5 hours. They played all of their great stuff. They played it all in the original keys at the original speed. It was just, it was really inspiring. So here's Read About It from, one of my absolute favorite records from this year.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 by Midnight Oil.
There's so many great touches throughout all of these songs, tiny little changes. There's an attention to all the little details. Each one of those little bass and drum parts comes back later in the song, and they're not just improvisations. They're part of it. And I'm a sucker for an angry singer. Like, you know, that the rich get richer and the poor get the picture is a pretty great first couplet.
Pretty great line, yeah.
For a rock and roll song. So this band got annoying at the end of the 80s when they were proselytizing and playing outside of the Exxon building. But they started as a weird, absolute kick-ass experimental rock and roll band from a little island. And I love that version of them. I love all the weird Australian records, which I've since tracked down and listened to. But especially, I love this one.
What's the name of the album, Jeff?
Countdown, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
What do you think, Ben Barton?
I'm a fan. Yeah, totally. And I like Jeff hit it all perfectly. Like that middle period, the Beds Are Burning period, and like the MTV stuff was pretty annoying. And so people think that they suck, but they don't suck, basically. And the earlier material is much better, much, much better.
I just remember hearing them. So you guys are talking about a sucky period, but that was my introduction to them. That, you know, how can we sleep when the beds are burning? I was like, I just want to have pop music, man. Why are you bringing me down? And it's his anger, Jeff, but it's not like this punk anger. It's much more localized. Like he knows exactly what he's angry at. And he
it's the worst kind of bar fight where a guy's mad and he's got all the statistics and you're just like, I'm just tired before this argument starts. You know what I mean? Like that's definitely what like dinner with Peter Garrett is like, I'll have the fish. Oh, you'll have the fish, will you? You know, and then there's going to be something really wrong with your fish order.
For yeah. Sure.
But that's funny coming from you because you know, you loved it when Bono was like, pounding the women and children.
Am I bugging you?
I don't mean to bug you. You were all in for that ridiculousness.
It must be the accent.
Yeah.
That Australian accent's all backwards. That's the problem.
All right, Timmy, what do you got, baby?
All right. Well, guys, I had, you know, John Cougar hasn't gotten any love. And so on my list here, where's my sheet? I've got American Fool. And he's got plenty of good songs on that. And then I've listened to it twice over the course of the day. And I got so annoyed at this just unhappy album. Like, I was like, oh, my God, just stop. And so I'm like, suddenly I'm like, I can't, you know, even though I want to give John Cougar love, this is a terrible album with terrible songs. And I can't believe I was going to choose. There's a song on it called China Girl.
And it's not the but it's a different one. But it's like, single China Girl.
What is it with so Rod Stewart, David Bowie, John Cougar?
Progress, by the way. 41 years later, if your leadoff single was called China Girl, you'd have some splaining to do. So that's good.
John Cougar says, "Take me to your jasmine place." Okay, that's not okay. Yeah. So I was like, "What am I doing? Why am I trying to reinvent the wheel?" Thriller is right there. I mean,
Timmy.
It's the one I listen to the most. It's the one that I've listened to the most since then. It's Michael Jackson. It's Thriller. Give me Wanna Be Startin' Somethin', Jeff Sines.
Nice.
Thriller by Michael Jackson.
Actually, an album I bought when I was 12 years old or 13 years old. I probably waited. I wanted to make sure it worked out.
You want to make sure every track is good before you
that's
shut
right.
out.
Yeah. Once the eighth single hit the top 10, I was like, okay, I'm going to buy it.
I have a spicy take. Are you ready?
Yeah, go.
The best songs on Bad are better than the best songs on Thriller.
Whoa! I love it.
Best songs on Bad.
Bad?
Yeah.
That's and Bad is basically it's the same song as what's the
Beat It?
Yeah, it's the same song as Beat It, but much vastly superior. Smooth Criminal is the same song as the song we just heard.
Smooth Criminal is unbelievable.
So good.
Superior. Then you get a little bit hurt here. Now I'm starting to run out of steam. That's why I said the best songs. I ride for Dirty Diana hard.
No.
I like me some Dirty Diana. With the Steve Stevens guitar part, all right.
So what about Billie Jean, though? What's matching up against Billie Jean? Don't say Dirty Diana.
Yeah, why not? I'll take Dirty Diana. Billie Jean is not my favorite. I'm not crazy about that one.
Huh.
I Don't love Stop Till You Get Enough. I is love the one Human where you Nature. Really human Nature is so great. That song's beautiful. You ever heard Miles Davis's Human Nature? He was obsessed with that song.
Oh, really?
Before he died. He played it every night. He played Human Nature and Time After Time. every night in the last tour of his life. Yeah, he was obsessed with both of them.
But Ben, you could not find anything on Bad to compete with Paul McCartney's The Girl Is Mine.
By the way, that song sucks. The thing about Thriller is there's two really bad songs, in my opinion. The Girl Is Mine is unforgivably howlingly bad. Like, it's Ebony and Ivory bad. And then PYT is some stupid
yeah,
stupidness.
That's uncomfortable as well.
But whatever. I mean, a record that gives as hard as this gives on 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 songs.
Hey, in Wannabe Starting Something, what is the lyric where they start singing "You're a vegetable"? What the heck's happening in that part of the song?
I'm a vegetable. Yeah. I don't know. I try not to think about
it. I'm a mineral. I mean, it's really goofy. That one. I love that one.
All right. Well, you guys are not
the
vegetables.
Lady in my life, too. That's not helping you out much.
So I've learned. That song sucks. Yeah.
And how does Baby Be Mine go?
Oh, remember, this has the weirdest drum intro ever. Listen, hold on. The beginning is like a total, like, fall down a flight of stairs. Where the hell is the beat? Check it out. That's pretty much boilerplate early 80s funk. I mean, Rick James in a bottle, you know?
Is this Quincy Jones producing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, big time.
All right. Yeah. Well, we are going to unpack a little bit more of this album as we go, because it's the best-selling album of 83 and of 84. So we're going to pick different tracks as we go along. Anything else to speak of?
This podcast will get released when Ben is in the air, flying to see Jeff Simons and the Jeff Simons Band live at the Ivy Room. So
for sure,
I am sorry.
You can
have
that.
You can
imagine that. Yeah. No,
I looked into flights. There's nothing that can get me back in time. Friday night.
The new Ted Lasso episode?
If we had a win tonight, I might have just gone, but no.
Right, gotcha. Now you're under the gun. You gotta pick off the patsy again.
It's Thursday night, September 30th.
Yes.
You and is it Matt, right?
Matt Jaffe and I are each playing a full set. Yep.
That's
each
so
celebrating
fun.
New CD releases. I have had my first rehearsal, my second rehearsal with the unbelievable band that was nice enough to say yes to playing with me is tomorrow night.
They look great. Yeah.
Dude, they sounded really good. I got to be honest. Like, I knew they would be good, but they were super generous and really
so
drilled
fun.
Down and learned all the little parts. It's going to be fun.
So I'm thinking Branson has a winter break. Yes.
I mean, maybe. I don't know what we have anymore.
Southeastern United States tour? Huh?
Sure. Absolutely. That'd be great. Are you the promoter?
I am the promoter.
Okay. And we're going to need 25K up front. And our writer is really, really complicated. But
a lot of yellow M&Ms, Timmy.
A lot of yellow
M&Ms. I can do the M&Ms more than I can the 25K. Yeah. All right, guys. I will see you in 1983.
Woo!
And actually,
Ben, will you be in California by then? Because we're going to do it live in the same space, right?
I guess we have to choose a suitable time. We'd have to do it on Friday, I guess.
Well, no. I mean, when are you going to get here on Wednesday?
Oh, too late.
Oh, really?
9:30 at night Pacific. I'm going to be a puddle.
Okay. Well, we'll do a post show then. We'll do a post show. That'll be great.
Might be Friday. All right.
That's what I mean. I can't do it after the show.
I plan
to be a puddle. You should have seen me. I needed to change my shirt twice in rehearsal. I can't even imagine what's going to happen when I'm actually on stage.
Let's go shirtless, man.
Let's do it. Get ready. Hey, if you're having as much fun as we are, leave us a review on iTunes, give us a rating on Spotify, iHeartRadio, wherever you listen to podcasts, give us a shout. And then check us out on Twitter or at our Facebook page, 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys. Electric Acid.
Welcome to the Candle Power Hour. Come with us backstage, behind the scenes of show business spanning over four decades and bringing you the experiences that can only be told by the people who were there.
Our guests are from the A-list, the F-list, and everyone in between. Get set for some of the most insane, hilarious, and inspiring stories you will ever hear.
I'm Mercury.
And I'm Diego.
Your host for the Candle Power Hour.
Ever thought about starting your own podcast?
Do you have a business or a message you want to share with the world?
Well, now it's easier than ever with Electricast. Hi, I'm Mark Netter.
And I'm Peter Rafelson. We're the founders of Electricast Media.
Whether you want to start a new podcast or already have one, join Electricast to grow your audience, monetize your content, and build your community.
With our simple sign-up, you get free promotion, world-class analytics, premium ads, and personal support.
Go to Electricast.com and join our community today.
Electricast. Transform your influence.
Electricast.